Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Linking Primary Prevention and Anti-Oppression Work in Ending conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Mr. David Lee. Mr. Lee, you may begin.
Thank you. This is David Lee from Prevention Connection, and I'm glad to have you here, and I'm joined with my colleague, Ellen.
Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. This is Ellen Yin Wyckoff. I'm with CalCASA, and we're very excited to have you all join us on this web forum on ending primary, on linking primary prevention and anti-oppression work in ending violence against women. One of the things that we wanted to kind of mention before we begin is that we know that in this 90-minute session, we have some phenomenal speakers that will be joining us and talking a little bit more about anti-oppression work and its link with primary prevention. But one of the things we wanted to mention is that in the 90 minutes, we hope to be able to address some of the questions and issues and begin the dialogue on how anti-oppression work is very key in the work that we have in ending violence against women. We also know that it is only a beginning discussion, and we will be looking at different opportunities and hopefully other opportunities and ways that in which we can continue discussion in the future. What I'd like to do is to kind of talk a little bit about Prevention Connection. And first of all, what you see is a picture, hopefully on your screen, that you'll see a picture of the folks that are part of the team. It is a project out of CalCASA. And David Lee, who you had met earlier in this web forum, is the project manager, and Chad Sniffen and Amy Loya and I are folks that we can assist you if you have any questions following the web forum. Some of the things that we offer through Prevention Connection, as you may go into our website when you signed up for this web forum, we offer podcasts, online presentations, and wikis. And I'll have David talk a little bit more about that. We also have the Prevent Connect listserv. If you haven't been a part of it, you can find it on preventconnect.org and sign up for that. We will also have continuing web conferences and web dialogues. And a lot of the web conferences and web dialogues, the materials and are archived on our website. And David, do you want to talk a little bit more about the wiki, please?
I'd love to be able to talk about the wiki. One of the things that we're starting at Prevention Connection is a wiki that's dedicated to primary prevention of violence against women. A wiki, if you're not familiar with it, is like Wikipedia. It's a user-generated website where people from the field are able to contribute. And what we've been doing on the wiki project is asking people who do violence against women prevention work, restricting it to only those people, to be able to build different entries about what violence against women prevention looks like. So, for example, you will find in here information on prevention materials, curriculum, and exercises that have been entered by people from the field. We want to encourage people to be able to enter this information so we can capture that information throughout the field and be able to share with other people about what we each are doing and build on each other's ideas. So we want to really encourage you to visit the wiki, and you can get to it from the Prevent Connect website. Let me just also talk about that. We do have upcoming web conferences, and our next web conference is going to be on October 10th, and it's going to be with the Family Violence Prevention Fund on what public opinion research tells us about men's willingness to support efforts to prevent domestic violence and sexual assault. And this will be held on October 10th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time. And that registration has opened today, and you can register at preventconnect.org. So I want to encourage you to be able to do that. I do want to familiarize you with the technology a little bit that we have here at Prevention Connection, and using the web technology so you can be familiar with what we will be doing. In this technology, we're able to do a lot of learning about who's on the call. So one thing that you can do is be able to indicate who you are by raising a hand. And if you look above the picture on the right, I'm going to circle that picture now, you can raise your hand. So can everyone try to raise their hand, please? Okay. Okay, great. So we've got people, and I know that people are still going to be coming into this line. We've been having a little bit of trouble with our audio, getting the audio. So great. We will be asking you to raise the hand to participate later on. I'm going to lower the hands right now. I know a few more people will do that. You also will be able to see in here who all the participants are, and we list the names, and that's the way that you can be able to get information available. We also have the text chat function. And the text chat's a chance for you to be able to do conversations. The text chat will be getting very big, so it's going to be very hard to be able to see. So one of the ways that we're going to be able to do that is if you click on the box in the upper right-hand corner, that will open up your text chat box, and then it makes it a lot easier to be able to send messages. I also want to encourage you can send a private message to people if you want to by clicking the private box. Another feature that we have is going to be our question and answers feature. And the way that our questions and answers feature operates is that we can be able to ask questions about the audience. So let's learn a little bit about who you are. The first question I want to ask is, what's the best description of your organization? Are you a sexual assault or domestic violence agency or coalition? Are you a business? Are you from a college or university-based program? Are you a local, state, or national public health organization? Or if you are something other, click number 5. So let's go ahead and see who is on the call. Great. And what I can do is I can also share the results so you can see who else is on this call. So as you will see, overwhelmingly, 2/3 of our audience are from sexual assault or domestic violence agencies or coalitions. We only have 1 person from a business. We have 10% from college or university-based programs, 12% from local or state or national public health organizations, and 9% of you are other organizations. So that's really great in getting a chance to know who is in here. I see that somehow the synchronized browser, I'm going to close that. Let's also get a sense of how many of you are experienced with with this. Can you please let us know if you have attended a previous Prevention Connection web conference? One, if you have, and 2, if this is the first time you've attended a Prevention Connection web conference. Great. I see that people are voting, and what we are seeing here is I will share the results with you all, that we have approximately 62% of you have attended a previous Prevention Connection, and 37% of you are new. So I'd like to welcome all of you who are new and welcome back all of you who have attended before. Prevention Connection does do a wide series of events, and we've been really doing quite a few web conferences over the years, so we've been very pleased with how those web conferences go forward. Okay, thank you. So I'm not going to close the answers here. We also will be having PowerPoint slides that you will see. You can get copies of the PowerPoint slides on our web page at www.preventconnect.org. So that's the place that we do have that information available. Just a couple other questions, and I know that people have been having a little bit. If you have troubles on the web, you can always send us a private text chat, and we will be able to get information to you that way. We also can you can call iLink Technical Assistance if you're having a problem. Some people want to know how to do private text chat. You have to open the box by pressing that square in the upper right-hand corner of the text chat box, and then you click private. Then, and actually those people sent private messages, so they knew how to do it. You can also call CalCASA at 888-922-5227, and Chad is there to be able to answer your questions. Let me have Ellen go over and talk a little bit about what CalCASA is, about what we do at Prevention Connection.
Thank you, David. Well, Prevention Connection is an opportunity for us to discuss a variety of prevention issues, and particularly our focus is on violence against women. Now, what we wanted to do is, for the purposes of this webinar and all the webinars that we offer, we want to kind of define what we mean about violence against women. We're talking about domestic violence, sexual violence, violence across the lifespan, and preventing violence before it starts, and also its connection to other forms of violence, which is why we're going to be discussing the linkages of anti-oppression work with preventing violence against women. The other thing that we wanted to share with you are some of the collaborative partners that we work with through Prevention Connection. We work with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, and you can see their link on your screen there, the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, PREVENT, which is Preventing Violence Through Education, Networking, and Technical Assistance out of the University of North Carolina. Prevention Connection is obviously one of the partners, and also VAWNet, the National Online Resource Center on Violence Against Women. One of the things that we want to acknowledge is that Prevention Connection is funded and sponsored by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the views and information that we're presenting in this webinar and on our listserv and web conferences do not necessarily represent the official views of the U.S. government, CDC, or CALCASA. So we just wanted to kind of clarify some of the background information and the collaborative partners that we have. What I'm really pleased to do right now is to kind of turn this over to our speakers for this event, Liz and Lisa, Elizabeth Waters and Lisa Fujia Parks. So Liz and Lisa, if you want to go ahead and start.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ellen. Thanks, David. I'm Liz Waders. I'm a program director here at Prevention Institute, and I'm really pleased to be joined by Lisa Fujia Parks, who used to work at Prevention Institute and is now a consultant and project manager for an LGBTQ domestic violence initiative in California. I want to welcome everybody to the web dialogue, Linking Primary Prevention and Anti-Oppression Work in Ending Violence Against Women. I also wanted to say that Lisa has extensive experience in the fields of oppression and violence against women, and we're really lucky that she can join us here today.
Thank you, Liz, and hello to everyone across the country. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be here today.
Great. Today's web dialogue is about something that's very close to us at Prevention Institute. Our motto is putting prevention and health equity at the center of community well-being. And all of our work is characterized by a commitment to creating equitable health and safety outcomes among all social and economic groups.
What we're going to be talking about today is how we can incorporate an anti-oppression perspective or anti-oppression principles into our work in primary prevention of violence against women. And it's an exciting, important, challenging topic. We are going to do our best to help focus our thinking and draw out some key issues.
Exactly. I want to start off by reviewing our agenda for today. We're going to begin with an introduction of the violence against women trajectory and a discussion of how root factors, like the many forms of oppression, contribute to violence against women. After that, we're going to define the three levels of oppression, which are internalized, interpersonal, and institutional, and talk about the importance of challenging institutional oppression in the work that we do to end violence against women.
And we have three guests today that we are so excited to have us join the conversation, Donna Marie Alexander, Yolanda Gauthier, and Virginia Gaytan. We're lucky to be joined by these representatives of two of the leading national women of color violence against women organizations, the Women of Color Network and Sisters of Color Ending Sexual Assault. These organizations play vital roles in addressing intersecting forms of oppression and violence against women prevention work. I'm also going to be contributing to the conversation from the perspective of my work in addressing institutional homophobia and heterosexism. After this conversation, we'll have interaction throughout the forum, but after the conversation, we're going to open up the phones and open up the dialogue to the entire group, and of course, we'll end with an evaluation.
Exactly. Well, let's get started first off by defining what we mean by primary prevention. For the people who are joining us for the first time in particular, prevention is a systematic process that promotes healthy environments and behaviors and reduces the likelihood or frequency of violence against women. Primary prevention means taking action before violence or risk factors to violence occur.
And here on the next slide, we have the trajectory of violence against women. This is a model that illustrates the directional relationship between root factors, environmental factors, or environmental contributors, and behavioral factors.
Exactly. And when most people think about preventing violence against women, they think about influencing individual behavioral factors like alcohol and drug use or hostility towards women. But as you can see from this trajectory, behavioral factors are shaped by factors in the environment, factors like media images and weak or non-existent community sanctions, which in turn themselves are shaped by root factors like the various forms of oppression, and by the intersection between root factors and the environment.
So let's take a moment now and hear from you all as we get started. When we say that different forms of oppression are root factors of violence, what are we referring to? Let's do a text chat now and brainstorm some of the forms of oppression.
Racism. That's one of the first ones we think of. Sexism is another one.
And some different ways of kind of describing that. Patriarchy or gender-based oppression, classism, poverty, transphobia, mentioned several times.
Mm-hmm.
Economic, financial inequity, ageism mentioned several times. Ableism, all the isms.
Yes, poverty.
Heterosexism.
Looksism, yeah.
It's so complex, and there's so many different dimensions to the way that power structure and inequality operates in our society.
Exactly.
Well, this is really great. This is an excellent list, male privilege, white supremacy. And I think what's coming out also is that there are different ways, different language, different terminologies that people might use, and I think that's great to have different terms. We're going to be using a certain set of terms in this web dialogue, and the different terms, we could have discussion about that, and it's helpful to talk about what is the best term to use and why, and, it's an ongoing, evolving conversation.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's close this text chat and move to the next slide.
Thank you. Oh, wait, what you see here, this slide is a trajectory of violence against women. And very often the link between what's in the environment and how this plays out in behavior is social norms. Now, norms are attitudes and beliefs that we take for granted, and they're often the tipping factors to changing behavior. So, for example, a root factor like sexism shapes our environment, including norms about expected male behavior and the media images we see. This, in turn, shapes individual behaviors, and for this reason, it's really important to focus on norms when we're taking a primary prevention approach to violence against women and thinking about what needs to be done to prevent violence in the first place. We've, at Prevention Institute, identified 5 norms that engender an environment in which violence against women can occur. And these norms are the general acceptability of violence, just that violence is everywhere, it's always been, that's the way things are. The second norm is that of traditional masculinity, how we think of men and what it means to be a man, the whole boys will be boys kind of argument. Limited roles for women, which often leads to the objectification and oppression of women. Or especially power over others, power and control over others, and the norm of privacy and secrecy. For example, that violence, domestic violence in particular, is something between a man and a woman or a husband and wife and isn't something that we should talk about or necessarily involve ourselves in. I want to say about norms as well, one of the important things that we need to focus on when we're going through today's discussion is that we want to strategize ways to address oppression in our work. And we found that at Prevention Institute, often addressing the norms, changing environment, changing the norms in the environment is a very concrete and tangible way to actually get at norms. So, for example, addressing the norm of scantily clad women in music videos is much more tangible than taking on sexism as a whole. So what we have here is a situation where norms are both a manifestation of different forms of oppression, and in a sense, they reinforce different forms of oppression.
We want you to remember as we go throughout the discussion today that norms are things that we take for granted. And so in essence, a society, as a society, we don't even notice how they play out at the individual, the interpersonal, or the institutional levels. And as we turn to these levels of oppression, we also want to keep in mind these norms. And I'm going to move the discussion now to Lisa, who's going to tell us a little bit about the different kinds of oppression.
Great. Oops. Okay, let's get on the right slide. Thanks, Liz. So I am going to introduce a framework for understanding different forms of oppression, which is kind of conveniently referred to as the three I's of oppression. And this kind of way of thinking about oppression as having different levels really comes from social change, social justice work that's really fundamentally rooted in an understanding of social structures, that society really is structured in a way that treats people unequally, which results in unequal power distribution. And a lot of the language that we are going to be drawing from today specifically comes from Dr. Kamara Jones' work in understanding racism, and there's an article to one of her, I mean, there's a link to one of her articles on the Prevention Connection webpage. So internalized oppression, first of all, is oppression that really is embraced and embodied within the oppressed individual. It's the way that oppressed peoples come to internalize, accept the stigmatization of their groups and negative messages about their own ability and intrinsic worth.
Exactly. So when we think about internalized oppression, we can think about it as being characterized by people not believing in others who are similar to themselves or not believing in themselves. Internalized oppression often involves accepting limitations of a person's own humanity, a person's right to self-determination, and a person's range of allowable self-expression. Interpersonal oppression, then, is prejudice and discrimination across individuals. When we talk about prejudice, what we mean is differential assumptions about the abilities, motives, and intentions of others according to their race, ability, or sexual preference, for example. Discrimination means differential actions towards others according to these characteristics. Interpersonal violence includes acts of omission and commission and can manifest as a lack of respect, suspicion, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jones refers to this as personally mediated oppression. It's another way of saying it. So let's talk about institutional oppression then. It's really where we want to focus our efforts today. Institutional oppression is differential access to goods, services, and opportunities of society based on gender, race, class, sexual preference, ability, and so many other factors. So, for example, this could mean people with disabilities having being discriminated against in searching for a job, people of color being discriminated against in looking for financing to buy a home in a neighborhood that's free of pollution, and so on. And institutional oppression manifests not just in material conditions, but so importantly, in differential access to power. It results in differential access to education, employment, housing, a clean environment, and so much more.
Exactly. So when we're talking about institutional oppression, we're really talking about the entities by which we group ourselves, things like along the lines of religion, fields of employment, government bodies, community groups, and so on.
It's all the institutions and the way that oppression is, institutionalized. So, you know, of course, all forms of oppression, internalized, interpersonal, they're all damaging and they're all important and they're obviously all interrelated. But today, because our focus is on linking oppression, anti-oppression with prevention, we really want to focus at the institutional level. It's the level that's most consistent with an environmental approach to prevention. And one of the quotes that I really like from Dr. Kamara Jones, she says that if you want to address oppression, you must address institutional oppression. And when you do, the other levels may take care of themselves.
And to that end, our next slide has a quote from Dr. Kamara Jones. Defines institutional racism as differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities of society by race. Institutionalized racism is normative, sometimes legalized, and often manifests as inherent disadvantage. It's structural, having been codified in our institutions of custom, practice, and law, so there need not be an identifiable perpetrator.
You know, I really like this definition, well, one, because it's so good, and also because I think it's really applicable to all forms of institutional oppression, sexism, homophobia, heterosexism, etc. And violence against women really needs to be viewed within the larger ecological context of our U.S. society that includes all of these different forms of oppression and that contribute to a wide variety of injustices and adverse health outcomes, including violence against women. So, in fact, what is known as intersectional theory on the next slide really emphasizes the interrelationship of systems of oppression. This approach is being embraced in numerous social justice movements and in progressive strands of public health. And I really like this quote that defines or says that central to intersectional theory is the tenet that racism and sexism, as well as other forms of oppression such as homophobia, ageism, and ableism, operate as mutually reinforcing systems of inequality. So we don't want to think of different forms of oppression as being isolated or separate from each other. We want to think of them as interrelated and mutually reinforcing.
And our charge today is to understand how institutional oppression contributes to violence against women and how to integrate an anti-oppression perspective into violence against women primary prevention strategies. To that end, we'd like to hear from everyone online right now. And we'd like to have you give us some examples of institutional oppression, meaning what are some of the ways in which oppression has been codified into our institutions of custom, practice, and law. And at the same time, I'd like people to let us know how institutional oppression directly contributes to violence against women. So, for example, are there specific ways that oppression contributes to violence against women? Please go ahead and text chat in now. Oh, great. Strip clubs, marriage laws, lack of access to marriage for same-sex couples, abortion laws, lack of female officers.
Police are being mentioned, healthcare, higher education, the legal system. I like the fact that people are really pointing to specific institutions and their practices and how they contribute to violence against women. Lower wages for women, limited employment opportunities. You know, it's when women have fewer choices,
exactly.
Access to housing, access to jobs, it creates vulnerability and dependency.
Mm-hmm. And this points back to the norm of limited roles for women.
Mm-hmm.
Religious faith traditions and rules, invisibility of domestic violence in same-sex relationships.
Anti-immigration law and the whole anti-immigrant climate contributes, you know, by so many institutions, contributes to violence against women who are immigrants themselves or perceived to be.
Religion-mandated gender roles. Media influence on people's self-esteem. When we talk about institutions, the media is a very pervasive institution of norms.
Inadequate health care for transgender people, non-accessible workplaces. Wow, so this is rampant. This is everywhere. People are not having a problem coming up with institutional oppression examples.
Great. Well, now that we've, these are all excellent examples of institutional oppression and how they impact violence against women. And these are striking reminders that interpersonal behavior and health outcomes are manifestations of institutionalized inequality. Now that we've come up with some really specific examples of how institutional oppression contributes to violence against women, and now that we've spent a little bit of time getting clear on the problem, I'd like to shift the discussion to get us to thinking about some solutions.
Mm-hmm. And feel free to continue to text chat examples as they come to you.
So let's move to this next slide. I really want to share this quote that does a great job of the importance of integrating an anti-oppression perspective, in this case, highlighting anti-racism, into our prevention strategy. So we need to be thinking about we need to understand oppression and incorporate our understanding into our prevention, because addressing the racism that permeates our society and remains evident in our social service and justice systems is essential to effectively addressing the violence that plagues our society. For example, when poor families and families of color are subjected to greater scrutiny and receive fewer supports and harsher penalties, prevention strategies that are not carefully crafted can cause real harm by perpetuating existing inequities. And of course, we don't want to do that. So with this quote in mind and with our understanding of really what we're talking about when we mean institutional oppression and how it contributes to violence against women, let's bring in our three guests. We are delighted to welcome Donna Marie Alexander of Sisters of Color Ending Sexual Assault. Donna, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Donna.
Hello. And we have Yolanda Gauthier, who is the Executive Director of Alternatives to Family Violence, and she's representing the Women of Color Network. Hello, Yolanda.
Hello.
Great to hear you. And Virginia Gaytan, Latina Outreach Coordinator of Alternatives to Family Violence. Welcome, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi, Virginia.
So thank you so much for joining us.
And these organizations are committed to addressing root factors of violence against women, including oppression.
So let's hear from you first, Donna. Can you tell us a little bit about Sisters of Color Ending Sexual Assault and just a little bit about how your work addresses intersecting forms of violence, intersecting forms of oppression?
Okay. As y'all know, my name is Donna Alexander. I'm a volunteer for Sisters of Color Ending Sexual Assault. I have 16 years of working in the movement of violence against women, primarily sexual assault. CSA is committed to, it's a sort of women-led organization committed to system-wide policies and social change initiatives related to sexual assault. We believe that women of color need to be at the table informing policies, creating policies, strategizing around policies. Our perspective is that we recognize all issues of oppression are linked, and for communities of color, they experience multiple layers in institutional oppression when dealing with violence against women.
Yes.
Our philosophy is to help women of color to understand their cultural heritage, their history, understand how that cultural heritage and history is connected to violence against women. Combat some of the images and the messages they get in the larger culture and community about their self-worth. We believe if we can't address their self-worth, they can't be leaders in the community, they can't, you know, speak at the table. So we work with media, we do, you know, traditional prevention kinds of work in the schools and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we believe that the women's movement has predominantly been a white women's movement, and we feel if we can raise their women of color's sense of leadership and the culture and the history, that they can actually be positive and make an impact on the work we do.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm really glad. I mean, there's so many points that I'm glad that you brought up. A couple things that struck me were bringing in the historic perspective. I mean, it's so important that we remember the history of oppression and how it's manifested today, and also the emphasis on leadership, giving voice, creating that place at the table. It's so important to be able to affect policies and shape our lives. So thank you for the work that you do and for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. And you know, here at Prevention Institute, you know, we're going to go a little bit later into the spectrum of prevention and your work with policy creation and getting women at the table in terms of strategizing around policy is one of the things that we talk about and how to increase that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to now introduce or meet Yolanda and Virginia of Alternatives to Family Violence and Women of Color Network. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. First, Yolanda, what is Alternatives to Family Violence?
Alternatives to Family Violence is a domestic safe shelter program operating both a safe house and a non-residential component. And within our non-residential component, we are developing a culturally specific program geared towards Latina women, specifically monolingual women.
Thank you. Virginia, along those lines, what is the Women of Color Network and how does it address intersecting forms of oppression?
The Women of Color Network, as a national entity providing technical assistance, resources, support, and leadership training to women of color advocates and advocates across the country.
This is Yolanda, and one of the things that the Women of Color Network was an outgrowth of women of color not having a voice within the systems of domestic violence and sexual violence. And at that point, women of color were applying for leadership positions within their own agencies and were being told that they lacked the skills necessary to become leaders within their organizations. And so the Women of Color Network said, all right, what we need to do now is to create programs that allow us to provide the training and education that our mainstream programs are saying that we do not have. And so with that in, began the Mentor Project, and we had a leadership and cultural competency training that was given, and we have done a number of women of color caucuses across the country in which we're looking at the issues of leadership, leadership development, program management, financial management to ensure that that women of color are equipped and able to meet that learning curve that mainstream programs have said that women of color do not possess.
Thanks, Virginia and Yolanda. I just wanted to say, kind of reiterating what Lisa said earlier, I mean, these are some wonderful opportunities here in terms of the mentorship, the leadership training, cultural competency training, financial management, because these all address different levels of increasing leadership, I mean, particularly the financial management training. I mean, we talk about how financial independence actually offsets a lot of the limited roles for women and the positions that that leads us into. We're going to talk a little bit now about the...
Okay, do you want to mention the what's new on this slide?
Oh, sure. Next week, the Women of Color Network will be in collaboration with a program in New Orleans, which is a national conference, and it's for women of color allies and colleagues, and it concerns the endangerment of the women of color advocates. And a call to men is really about a call to men who are ending domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. And more information people can get by calling your office or logging onto your website.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, I hope many people do join you. I will be on the call tomorrow. Okay, thank you. So I just wanted to take a few minutes to talk a little bit about a project that I'm working on here in California. It's the California Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Questioning Domestic Violence Technical Assistance and Training Project. That's a very long name. It's a project that's funded by the California Department of Public Health, and it provides technical assistance and training to California's 94 Department of Public Health-funded domestic violence agencies. It's sort of a phenomenal investment of public funding into addressing LGBTQ issues in California, so it's a really exciting opportunity. It's aimed at increasing access to services among LGBTQ domestic violence victims and survivors, and though the initiative is not defined as an anti-oppression initiative per se, addressing oppression based on gender identity and sexual orientation is an integral strategy for the project. So I want to just talk a little bit about why it's so important that this project addresses oppression based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and then describe a little bit about how we're going about doing that, particularly at the institutional level. So addressing oppression is important first, in this case, to provide accessible and effective services. Domestic violence agencies need to be able to provide a safe and welcoming environment for LGBTQ individuals that is free from interpersonal and institutional oppression. It's fundamental to providing effective services to the LGBTQ community. And second, it's important to address oppression in order to contribute to and support prevention. Because oppression based on sexual orientation and gender identity are underlying contributors to sexual violence and domestic violence and other forms of violence, anti-oppression efforts really do contribute to prevention. And I want to just give a couple examples of that. You know, Suzanne, or still on the previous slide, Suzanne Farr made the notion that homophobia is a weapon of sexism famous, and I think it's so relevant to violence against women prevention. Homophobia and other oppressions reinforce rigid gender roles and unhealthy expectations of relationships, and they really contribute to the conditions that support violence against women. And it's not just violence against women. You know, Liz, there was a recent study that showed that among the 28 cases of random school shootings in American high schools between 1982 and 2001, the majority of the boys who opened fire had routinely experienced homophobic bullying. So regardless of whether that person is homosexual or gay or otherwise, homophobia affects all of us, and it's being looked at as a risk factor for all kinds of violence. So addressing these forms of oppression really contributes to violence prevention.
I just want to jump in just for a second here and, you know, talk about, again, just thinking about norms and what's mm-hmm. acceptable and what's not. And that example that you just used,
yeah.
It goes right back to our traditional masculinity
mm-hmm.
and gay bashing and how that's related to oppression. But also here, it strikes me as, you know, when we talk about that's so gay, how that's a very popular term now. This is precisely what leads into acts of violence against people, whether they are gay or not.
Exactly. It's tolerated. It's sort of normalized. So what are we doing? We're trying to address oppression, particularly at the institutional level, in the following ways. One is that participation in this technical assistance and training is required for all of the 94 agencies, and there's mandatory participation by executive directors. That's mandated by the state of California. So it brings in institutional leadership and says this is important. Everyone needs to participate. Everyone needs to take it seriously at the policy level. Second, we're doing 16 regional training of trainers that are really aimed at building capacity to conduct ongoing LGBTQ domestic violence training for all staff and volunteers. So the ongoing work is not dependent on this project. We're really building local capacity so that this effort is sustained. And I think institutional efforts really are about sustained change, not just a one-shot deal, but really institutionalizing the change. And some of our training and technical assistance topics include, one, skills to identify and address homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, and heterosexism among staff, community members, and clients, how to develop written policies like non-discrimination policies and procedures, best practices, and protocols for serving LGBTQ clients. And third, we're doing training on what's called continuous quality improvement so that agencies can adopt this approach of ongoing improvement, ongoing changes, and fostering and measuring these improvements over a 3-year period, and hopefully with all of these efforts to institutionalize all of this beyond the 3-year period.
Wonderful.
So our guests and what I just shared, I think I know that I've heard some really great examples of what organizations are doing to address institutional oppression. So let's keep going in focusing on generating ideas and solutions. And we'd like to hear from our guests now about some more specific examples, either within your own organizations or things that you have seen or would like to see that really take our commitments to challenging oppression, challenging institutional oppression, and have woven those commitments into primary prevention work. So please jump in and share your thoughts. Or take a moment and then jump in.
Oh, let's start with Donna again.
Okay. I mean, one of the things that I thought about in sort of thinking about this question is trying to address, for example, let's talk about the police. addressing their policies and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Here we call it general orders, but one of the things that, you know, currently to make sure that it's stated clearly in their policy, for example, that they don't ask about immigration status onto a DV scene or investigating a sexual assault, versus knowing that's not their role, but to make sure it's clearly stated in their general orders that, you know, that they're not supposed to ask immigration status, and getting them out there to tell the community that, because it's, you know, it's hard to reach out if you're afraid that, you know, your immigration status is going to be you know, attacked or addressed or dealt with. So one of the things I, when I thought about this question, one of the strategies is to take a look at, you know, orders to make sure that those kind of languages are clearly stated. This is a policy that we don't do.
Mm-hmm.
In silent, because sometimes when it's silent, officers have a tendency to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm. I like, I mean, you're talking about a specific, you know, way that oppression is institutionalized within the police system, and, you know, working at the policy level to create a different standard and enforcing that standard. I think that's a great example. It's, you know, it's a way to change the way that sexual assaults and domestic violence cases are responded to by law enforcement. And it's important. It's critical. I want to hear more from you, Donna, and also from our other guests. You know, just to restate or reiterate the question, we want to focus on examples of primary prevention. So the kinds of things that community groups, public health departments, state coalitions, other partners can do to really change the environments and conditions that are contributing to violence against women to prevent it from happening in the first place.
Right. And I would just like to ask Virginia and Yolanda this time, either programs that you're aware of or things that you would like to see if there aren't any things out there that fit all the needs that we're talking about. What's missing?
Right now, this is Virginia, I'm sorry. But right now I do have a group program, my Comadres Group, and it's a monolingual psychoeducational group. And I do touch a lot about oppression, about how they don't know how to speak English. So
mm-hmm.
a Spanish group that I facilitate. And right now I have about, I would want to say, about 25 women there. And what we do is I give them referrals, information, where to go, how to get free English classes, how to obtain their own GED without even, you know, trying to speak English, they can do a GED in Spanish. Free resources where they can get medical attention and without having insurance. And other just all around how to give them ideas of how to teach their kids, you know, not to punish them by pinching them or not to punish them by, you know, spanking them, you know. Forms of how to educate the kids and be have a healthy relationship all around with their husband and their kids also. And I've been getting a lot of feedback as to how it works in their environment and that it's progressing, you know, in their lives, everyday lives. And they thank me a lot every single day. They tell me that this Comadres group is working for them. So I'm very happy that it is working and that I'm still getting women in and that I'm trying to form another one in January. But I'm very proud of my Comadres group.
We're losing you a little bit, Virginia. It's a little bit difficult to hear. Can you just maybe bring the phone a little bit closer?
Hello? Is this better?
Yes.
Yes.
But thank you for sharing that example. I mean, I think just the fact that you're working with the community that you're working with, you know, so much, I mean, one of the ways that I think we can do a better job in primary prevention is to make sure that those efforts reach some of the groups that traditionally are not reached. And so the efforts that you're making to ensure that this group of young people receives this information and education and support, I think is really vital. And that's one way that we can all incorporate that commitment to anti-oppression into our prevention work.
Precisely. And one of the things that we deal with, you know, we've been talking about the three I's of oppression.
There's so much interpersonal oppression around us, and Virginia, a lot of the stuff that you were describing is really wonderful in terms of helping women get around the interpersonal oppression to move through institutional levels of oppression, bolstering their skills to navigate the system better. But there's so much interpersonal oppression around us, and we could have a full-time job trying to address it just by itself. But if we don't address the institutional roots of interpersonal oppression, we'll never get to the source. And what I want to ask the three of you now is, how do we get to the institutional roots, especially for people who are burdened by the interpersonal oppression every day? And this one I'm going to throw out to you, Yolanda, first.
Well, I believe that probably one of the easier things that an agency can do, which is what we've done, has been to conduct a cultural audit. Just how do we work? What are those institutions that have been created within our own organization, both knowingly and unknowingly, mm-hmm. and what have we perpetuated as this is the way Alternatives does business? And oftentimes what happens is our unspoken rules are the ones that seem to prevail. And so our agency went through a cultural audit, and this definitely predated me, but it was, what I would say is it was one of the building blocks that allowed us to get to where we are today. We now have within our organization specific groups for women of color and for white women in which we talk about the impact of our internalized oppression and how it has created this institutionalized racism within our own agency.
Wow.
We've also looked at that and said, what can we do? What is the commitment that each person who works here makes to working not only on our agency's institutional approach, but also, what are we willing to do in working on ourselves? Because I believe that they do go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
I can't blame the system if I'm unwilling to change things within myself.
Mm-hmm.
I can't blame the system if I am saying, or making homophobic statements.
Mm-hmm.
And then just saying, oh, I was just joking. I was just kidding. And so we continue to work on that. We have made we've made commitments to each other to call each other on language.
Yeah.
When someone in our office, if it's a woman of color, who says, "Oh, I'm just so dark," other women of color confront that.
Yes.
Why are you saying that?
Yes.
Yes, language is a very pervasive one.
Yeah.
Here at Prevention Institute, for example, I have this game that I play with one of my managing directors and trying to take violence out of our language. And it's very challenging, you know. I mean, we want to take a stab at a draft, or we're going to knock an idea about, you know, just the way that we talk. You know, if we put a quarter in a jar every time we came up with, you know, something that was violence-related, we would be very wealthy right now. But, you know, we're becoming so desensitized to it.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought up the use of the word dark. I mean, it's just so accepted to, you know, anything that's dark is bad.
Exactly.
So thank you for bringing that up. And what I really like about what you're saying is that there's that commitment to doing the personal work and the institutional, I'm sorry, the interpersonal work, but it doesn't stop there. And I think so often we can stop there. And we have to say, you know, how do we change the norms and the practices within our own organizations so that it's not just me trying to do this education every day to my colleagues, but this becomes the standard and what's accepted in our expected in our organization.
Precisely.
So I want to actually turn to the next slide. I hope it's the next slide, which is a quote that talks about what you're talking about. This comes from the Reshape newsletter of the Sexual Assault Coalition Resource Sharing Project, and I'm sorry it doesn't have the specific name of the author there, but I didn't see it. But anyway, regardless, this quote says that organizations like individuals can evolve to become anti-racist and I would add anti-homophobic, et cetera, and the transformation begins with developing a comprehensive understanding of how racism and oppression operate within an organization's own walls, the audit that you talked about. And from that analysis comes a commitment and concrete plans for dismantling racism within the organization and in the larger society. So I would love to hear any other, you know, suggestions that any of our guests have for how do we institutionalize this commitment within our own organizations.
Hello?
Yes.
This is Donna. I think it's also important to look at our hiring practices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we think about hiring and our recruitment practices, and do we really need that person with an MSW or, you know, or with advanced degree, are we limiting our who we bring on around classes and just looking at our hiring practice, looking at our recruitment practice, looking at who we bring on to do the work. You know, I think it's important to take a real good look at that.
Yes, and valuing different kinds of perspectives, different kinds of skills that are so important to doing this work.
So often I hear, you know, it's hard to hire women of color or it's hard to find women of color to work in the movement. I'm just wondering, you know, what are we doing? Are you looking at your recruitment process where you can't find women of color to work with you in this work?
Right. And, you know, almost saying that it's the fault of the women of color instead of saying, well, what can we do institutionally?
Mm-hmm.
What barriers are there that we might be even creating that we can
Correct.
Work to change?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, one of the things when you talk about hiring practices, this is Yolanda, is that we really looked at that. And when we have said, exactly, do we need this person with an MSW? Do we need this person who has this lengthy history of being involved with domestic or sexual violence? One of the pieces that we believe that that's important, but we can teach someone the domestic violence protocol for our agency or the sexual violence protocol for our agency. What we can't teach are those cultural components that person brings with them to our program. And those are the pieces that help us to step outside of ourselves and to be able to say we are more than just the degree that the person has. We recognize the other skills that they bring with them that We just wouldn't know how to advertise for those other skills, those interpersonal, those cultural components that person brings with them.
Mm-hmm. And these are all very important when we're talking about representation as well, because dealing with diverse populations, it's very, very important to have a diverse workforce internally as well, when we're talking about cultural competency. And then this is, from my background in academia, this has always been a big issue, and I'm really glad to hear how different people are addressing this.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes. I heard a hello.
Well, it sounded like something clicked off. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So we have some time for maybe, you know, we have two follow-up questions that we really want to get to and then open up the lines for discussion with the full group. One thing that I want to make sure we get to is I'm so glad that the notion of institutionalizing these principles into our own organizations has come out so strongly, and it's so important. I want to kind of dig a little bit deeper into what does it look like in our prevention initiatives and our prevention programming and our prevention strategies, because that's kind of another way that we take these principles out into our work. One example that I wanted to share, which I think is great, and it's a local example, is that San Francisco Women Against Rape has a new prevention initiative now where they're working in the neighborhood where their offices are located, the Mission District. And they're working specifically with women who are homeless or marginally housed. And their prevention initiative is really looking at prevention of violence against women who are homeless or marginally housed. And they're not only working directly with the women in the neighborhood, but they're also working institutionally to try to influence the management practices of the single room occupancy hotels that so many of these women are, so many of the women are living in part of the time, to look at how they can increase their safety measures and decrease the tolerance for violence that so often the management practices entail. And so what I like about this is that they are they're addressing the you know, the sexism, the economic oppression, particularly with the women of color in the neighborhood, and they're addressing it at a policy level by saying, what are the conditions that are making life unsafe for the women in the neighborhood, and how can we change those practices and policies? Who can we hold accountable? And they're specifically working with these the building owners and managers, getting, you know, and then taking it to that policy level. So that's one example I wanted to share. I'd love to hear other examples, you know, if people are know of maybe media advocacy initiatives that are really taking the anti-oppression approach, or any other thoughts or examples you have of how groups can incorporate these principles into the work that they're doing.
And while we're thinking about this, I want to turn the discussion right now to the spectrum of prevention, which is a tool that we use at Prevention Institute to start strategizing ways to address violence against women. And a lot of the strategies that we've heard today have focused at almost every level. And we found that, I mean, particularly, you know, I'm really struck by the financial management skill building, the leadership skill building, the mentoring. A lot of these are the strengthening individual knowledge and skills, promoting community education. Most of us are members of coalitions and networks, and a lot of our discussion today has focused on changing organizational practices, looking internally at the agencies that, that we work in. And, you know, at the one of the more challenging levels, we have influencing policy and legislation. And I'd like to open this discussion up to everyone now and ask specifically, how can we use the spectrum, particularly at the organizational practice and policy and legislation levels, to incorporate anti-oppression perspectives into the work that we do to end violence against women?
Is that a text chat or
yes.
Lines? Text chat. Okay.
Text chat and lines open, yes.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
If people want to comment by through the phone line, if you could just raise your hand and then we can call on you to speak. We certainly welcome your participation that way and also through the text chat.
Right, we have lots of good examples coming through here. I mean, one of the ways that we could look at this is if we choose a venue such as a business. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
The phone line just cut back in.
Oh, sorry. Thanks for letting us know. Yeah, Lisa was going to tell us about some of the things that are coming up on the text chat now.
Sure. There's one request for people to share the audit. Is that something that you can share, Yolanda, the cultural audit?
What I would have to do is to go back through our files. I'm very willing
okay.
to share it, but, well, I mean, I can't do it today.
Yeah.
So what I would be willing to do is go back through our files, get the name of the person and their current contact information.
Okay.
And then I can send that to Ellen or David, and then they should feel free to use it in whatever way
okay.
They deem necessary.
Great. And other folks, if you know of similar kinds of audits, please text chat in. I know that, you know, the Boston Public Health Commission a number of years ago
did a racism audit, and they looked inward and asked that question, how is racism operating here, and developed a whole undoing racism initiative for the city of Boston based on their findings. And that would be something that would be worth trying to get a hold of as well. We're seeing lots of interesting examples. I'm trying to comb through here. Someone's mentioning building stronger coalitions with partners who are working on oppression issues such as houselessness, and that they're doing a project called the People's Project. I do think that we need to think creatively about who we're partnering with. Who else has that same shared agenda of addressing the underlying conditions and the institutional oppression? There are so many folks who are working on it from different angles, and how can we partner with them to create a win-win situation?
Exactly. I mean, I see a I see a comment here addressing the need for the involvement of men in the movement, and that's very important. It says here women cannot prevent IPV or sexual assault. And we're talking about partners. I mean, I think is very important when we think about who our allies are as well.
Mm-hmm. Someone's saying here that establishing the policy doesn't guarantee enactment or enforcement, rather makes the institution look good, but the policy enactment and implementation is unfunded, so only on paper cover. Funding, one of my favorite things to talk about. So how can we influence the practices of funders so that they take anti-oppression work seriously? You know, I apologize if I'm wrong in this, but I thought that I saw that Colorado is doing some interesting work with integrating anti-oppression principles into RPE funding. Is that correct? Can anyone speak to that?
Well, this is Yolanda and Virginia, and it's interesting that language is being used, but it's sometimes very difficult to see that happen in practice. Oftentimes what we tend to see is, yes, we have the language and we have people who will apply, and at one point it was that every agency would engage in a cultural considerations training. And then that just sort of fell by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of our local groups that incorporates a very watered down cultural considerations training into their annual conference. And a part of the reason that it is watered down is because participants have complained about the hard work that is involved in doing this. Why does it have to be so hard? Why do we have to do those things? And so the trainers have started gearing things towards that feedback that they received, rather than to say, this is the way in which we need to be doing business.
Mm-hmm.
To tell, for a funder to add the language and then have an agency respond by thinking, oh, all we have to do is translate our brochures
right
into Spanish for the 900th time.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that then funded, they believe that they've met
right
those standards. And it doesn't push people any further than that.
Yeah, you know, it is hard work. I mean, and so often people do want to say, you know, well, let's do what's doable. And, you know, what I say to that is, do we want to prevent violence against women? You know, if that's the case, then it's not an option, that we really do need to do the hard work of getting at some of these underlying factors. We don't want to deceive ourselves into thinking that if we just do the easy work, then we'll get there. But it is really difficult, and I don't know if you have recommendations to encourage people to give support for how hard this work is in advocating for this work when so many people, you know, find ways of getting around it. But I see that Dawn Haney has raised her hand, and we would love to, if you could unmute her phone line so we could hear from you, and we encourage
more folks to also raise their hand and join in the conversation.
Yes, and we've got about 10 minutes left before we go into the evaluation, so we'd like to open up the conversation to everyone now. And we'd like you to text chat in any questions or comments that you have for our three guests. And if you'd like to speak with us on the phone, please raise your hand and we'll bring you onto the line.
Do we have Don? Can we open up Don Haney's phone line, please? I'm not unmuted. Are you interested in making a point?
Yeah, I am. Am I here now?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yay. Lisa, you had just said something about the work that Colorado is doing, and I am in an agency in Colorado that's funded through RPE dollars, and I wish someone from the state public health department was on here because they could talk a little bit more. But I do think Colorado is trying to do some really good work about actually integrating anti-oppression concepts into our rape prevention education. For the past couple of years, our statewide training with this funding has focused specifically on anti-racism and building that, sort of looking at that both in shifting individuals to having an anti-racism framework as well as agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just moved to hopefully what will be a 3-year funding process where communities around the state are engaging diverse community members from LGBTQ communities, rural immigrant communities, and both rural and urban native communities, in sort of having those folks be part of the dialogue on what sexual violence prevention is about.
Mm-hmm.
And those three sets of folks were identified by a state prevention team, which Catherine Guerrero would be the person at the state level of Colorado to talk more in depth about that. But she's really put together a team of people so that the folks who are determining what's going on statewide prevention are primarily women of color setting the agenda. So I think that it's some pretty exciting work, and I feel really fortunate to be able to be doing some of that on the local level. So I just wanted to share that with folks, what we're trying to do in Colorado.
Great. Thanks. Thanks so much, Dawn.
You're welcome.
I have a question now for Yolanda, Virginia, and Donna. You all spoke about recruitment, but can you speak a little bit about how you work on providing a supportive environment for women of color on staff?
Well, I think this is Donna. I think that it's important to have whatever you call them, caucuses or for women of color to come together to talk about issues, to deal with safety. I think it's important for, the dominant group, white women, to continue to do their work and be able to recognize they have work to do, whether that's through their own caucus or whatever, so it's something that's sort of institutionalized and that they're actually trying to do the work, and it's something that's sort of scheduled or set aside a period of time to really begin to take a look at this issue. So it's not one training that you do, but it's something that the organization does on a yearly basis to make it more comfortable for women of color in organizations to speak their mind, have leadership, and to begin to work on, helping set policies or procedures or programs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Yolanda and Virginia?
Yes, this is Virginia. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. We here at Alternatives, our staff, we usually get together and talk about our what we've done, at the Safe House, and what we do here in the administrative office, and we talk about how we can get together as a team,
mm-hmm.
and not, talk together about how we can grow as a team and grow as an agency, not being separately, and we also have groups as women of color group and white people group, and they go ahead and talk about their issues of what their issues are, coming from the women of color at our agency, and what our agency of women of color talk, what kind of issues do we have up in the white women of color. So let me transfer you to Yolanda.
Okay, thanks.
One of the other things, I guess, that I would say is that our management team is over 60% women of color, and that has had a tremendous impact on the way in which issues are addressed. So, you know, while I would certainly encourage everyone to include all of those perspectives when you are looking at managers within the organization, because it brings a greater, more variety. It brings a greater respect for each other, and just a wealth of information. The other thing that has also happened is that for us, our community outreach, we're a small agency of 14 full-time employees, and our community outreach and support team are all women of color, and all they are both bilingual and bicultural, because that was really important. Yes, I understand that you can be Anglo and speak many different languages, but it was important to our clients that we had women of color who looked like them, who sounded like them, who could also speak Spanish, and because that's the primary language that that's requested for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have women who not only speak Spanish, but we have in our safe house, we have bilingual, bicultural women who speak up to 7 or 8 different languages.
Mm-hmm.
And those, that was important for us as well. We've looked at our hiring practices. We've also looked at our operating policies and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, and I think that women who have children, it doesn't matter across the board, when your child is sick, what do you do, and you have to, you're working, maybe they threw up at school, but they're not running a fever, but you have work to do. We have created a system by which women can bring their ill children, as long as they're not infecting the rest of the office, they can bring those children to work and have them sit in the offices with them. For women with very young babies, we have a policy that says you can bring your child to work with you until your child is about 8 months old.
Wow. So you really have been very thorough in thinking through how to create, how to integrate this into your workplace practices.
Yes.
You know, I just want to add that because we've talked so much about recruitment and the importance of having a diverse staff, which I completely agree with, but I also think it's not to say that then the anti-oppression work is up to those people who, you know, who are there representing those communities. And one model that I really like is Asian Women's Shelter in San Francisco. They have a homophobia busters committee, and it's actually made up of non-lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women. It's the heterosexual identified women in the organization that take responsibility for doing that audit around homophobia and doing the ongoing work around challenging what goes on in the shelter, et cetera. So that's another model. And we have so much more to talk about.
But so little time. So before we move into the evaluation, I want to do two things. I want to, first of all, ask people to text chat in any resources that you found to be helpful in terms of incorporating an anti-oppression framework into the work that you're doing to end violence against women. And I'd also like to ask our guest, what are the important next steps in the work that we're doing?
Well, one of the things I wanted to sort of say, we sort of, and I realize that we have a lot to talk about. We were talking about policies and procedures. One of the things CSA has been working hard on with the reauthorization of violence against women is to have some set-aside money for communities of color to be able to use in their communities as they, prevention work and access to resources for prevention work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wanted to sort of say that when we were talking earlier about policy and procedures.
Is that the VAWA?
Yes.
Oh, it's such a great example. It's such a success. Thank you for your work on that. Gets back to the funding issue. So
yes,
thank you.
The money issue and the funding issue.
Yes. It looks like Elisa has her hand up.
What is the name, ma'am?
Yes, Elisa Covarrubias.
We're going to try to squeeze you in, Elisa, if you can find her and open up her line.
Yes, ma'am. Her line will now be open.
Thank you.
Can you hear us?
Yes.
Elisa? Okay. My name is Nancy Levy. I'm here with Elisa.
Okay.
And I have a question just to open to the group. That it's my understanding that, and the notes that I'm taking, is that clearly what we're looking for is how to address institutional contributors to domestic violence. And I understand the role of oppression, and certainly I'm a big proponent of working against oppression, and I think it will change a lot of aspects of all of our social problems throughout the community.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that we could take a continuum of women who are victims of domestic violence, and we could take the highest part of that continuum that we might call the least oppressed. We might say they're the most educated, they have the most financial knowledge and are able to handle it themselves, they have good careers and that sort of thing, and yet, depending upon the partner that they've chosen to share their life with, are still victims of domestic violence. So I guess that's where my concern is in terms of how do we address the larger issue of victims of domestic violence and preventing that in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to go to evaluation in a minute, but I do want to say that, one, we're talking about violence against women, not just domestic violence, and also no one is suggesting that we try to rank who is more oppressed or who is more in need of services.
And I would like to say that I know we focus a lot of times on sexual violence and domestic violence and on sexism, and I guess from my perspective, we have to address all the isms.
Yes.
In order to change the violence that women experience, and
mm-hmm.
all issues are isms are connected. So we have to focus, and I think one of the challenges is to help the movement recognize that we got to focus on all the isms if we really want to change violence against women.
And it's time to close. There's obviously so much more to do. I want to have more forums. Let's have a national convening. Let's do policy papers. Let's do all kinds of resources to expand this work and build on the great work that's already been done.
Yes. I just want to say thank you to all our three guests. And before we give it back to David to lead us into the evaluation, Donna Alexander, from Sisters of Color Ending Sexual Assault, Yolanda Gauthier and Virginia Gaetan of Alternatives to Family Violence and the Women of Color Network. And Lisa, it was a real treat to have you back with us today, and your insight on this issue really helped us move forward on looking at how we can incorporate anti-oppression work into our prevention of violence against women. I also want to thank everyone who's online who joined us and stuck with us throughout all of this, all the wonderful comments that people have been making, and especially additions to the resource list. I'm going to go ahead and pass it to David before we say goodbye, but I wanted to thank everyone, and please continue with the wonderful work that we're doing across the country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank everyone. I really appreciate this really valuable discussion. Prevention Connection is committed to continuing this discussion and exploring in greater depth. We do encourage that these get discussed on the Prevent Connect listserv. People can add items to the Prevent Connect wiki. And we are also looking for people that want to comment on this to be able to make podcasts and that we can record a wide variety of voices sharing their impressions on this. So in the evaluation, which you should see on your screen, you can go ahead and fill out in the comment section if you want have anything that you want to be able to add or be interviewed for a podcast, let us know with your contact information, and we can be able to follow up for that. I want to thank once again all of our guests, Donna Alexander, Virginia Gaetan, Yolanda Gauthier. I want to really thank Lisa Fujia Parks and Elizabeth Waiters, and also my colleagues Ellen Yin Wyckoff and Chad Sniffen, who's behind the scenes, and Amy Loya, who's also behind the scenes, for doing this. This will be concluding the audio portion. The presenters should stay on the phone, for we will be having a debrief session. A copy of the recording of this session will be posted on our website, in addition to the text chat. and a transcript of this session. So you will be able to get information. We will be sending that an email to all of you about that. So I'd like to thank you all and look forward to having you join us on another Prevention Connection activity. And thank you much. So presenters, please stay on the line. And this will now, I'm going to hand it back to the operator who will conclude the audio portion.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.